Well, we're still talking about unsolved murders and hauntings. And tonight, this is a pre-recorded show, since this is Thanksgiving. I have family demands that require that I be elsewhere at the time my show normally airs. And one of the stories I wanted to talk about took place in England, where the dead used to be buried at churchyards rather than in separate cemeteries. In the city of London, there was a chapel called Enon, where the Reverend always accepted any dead bodies. Now, one reason for this is there was money to be made from accepting the bodies. There's always a charge. I mean, if you check into, most people are buried through a funeral home, and your funeral home pays the church. Or the cemetery, depending on the situation. At this small chapel in England, though, because the Reverend was so keen on raising money for his church, he accepted far more bodies than he actually had room for. Now, with diseases rampant at the time, such as the Black Plague and other insidious maladies running through the local citizens, the death rate at the time was unusually high. The Reverend would be offered about 50 dead bodies a week. Now, the crypt he had at his disposal was tiny, but he always continued to accept delivery of more bodies, and he always had his hand out for that fee. Soon there were more than 12,000 bodies piled up, one on top of the other, from floor to ceiling inside that crypt. He didn't have coffins for them, he just left them lying on top of each other. And it wasn't long before the gases from the piles of dead bodies began to seep through the floorboards of the crypt, and soon the people walking by could smell the stench of the gases from the dead bodies. And not only that, but corpse flies were everywhere, and they would attach themselves to people as they walked by. Now, eventually, there was simply no way that any more bodies could be put inside the crypt, so they were accepted by the Reverend and to be put on in a cart and taken down to the River Thames to be dumped into the water. Now, sometimes an arm or a leg or even a head would roll from the carts onto the street in front of people walking along. Eventually, it was reported to the authorities, and they came and inspected and ruled the crypt was unfit for its purpose and it was sold off by the church. A few days later, it was turned into a dance hall by the company that had bought it. And as you might guess, the dances that were held there were known as Dances of the Dead. Well, when London suffered the Black Plague outbreak, hundreds of thousands of people died. Death became so prevalent that special pits had to be dug in which to put the numbers of dead bodies. Now, these pits were nothing special. They were just holes that had been dug so the authorities have a place to dump the bodies. None of the bodies received traditional burial rites because they were deemed to be contagious, and frankly, there were just too many of them to worry about it. It's thought to be impossible to conduct official burials. The pits were also dug on ground that was unconsecrated, and for religious believers, this was a definite no-no, and those who attended church made it a point to ignore what was being done. For most citizens, it was considered extremely bad karma to go anywhere near this, what they considered heathen land. So not only did the London population live in fear of becoming victim of the Black Plague, but they also feared going anywhere near the pits, for fear they would be sent to hell when they died. Now, no one was officially allowed near the pits anyway, although some poor desperate souls were so close to death after contracting the plague, they'd go there and throw themselves into the pits with all the other dead bodies, whether they were dead or not, because they knew they'd be dead soon. Usually the pit workers would dig them back out and send them on their way, but sometimes they were so far gone they just left them. Other more sinister pit workers existed too, and some of the things they did were truly horrifying. Some of them pulled human bones out of the pits and offered them for sale for various reasons. One pair of pit workers would hold secret events for paying visitors who would go there to gape at the women's naked bodies that the two pit workers had dug out of the pit and exposed in explicit positions. I guess you could say folks were dying for the excitement. Well, in 1979, after she was caught, Karen Greenlee told reporters, "I find the odor of death very erotic." She'd been caught having sex with dead bodies when she worked as an embalmer for a funeral home in California. And predictably, she said, "The group I find particularly attractive are young men in their 20s. But she does prefer that they be dead." Now, she was happy to explain her lifestyle. It's convenient for her, working in the funeral homes. She had the keys, so she'd slip back after hours and spend all night there. She'd also break into other funeral homes. It's more prevalent than people imagine. The funeral homes just don't report it. One place she got into, they actually caught her in the act, but they didn't want to get undue notoriety, so they let her go. Nothing seemed to stop her from fulfilling her gruesome desires. She progressed to stealing a hearse that contained the coffin of a young man and abducted him, I guess you could say. Driving off, and she wasn't found until 2 days later. When police finally tracked her down in another state, she was arrested. What they didn't know at the time was that she'd left a letter in a dead man's casket with his body. In this letter, she confessed to having sexual relations with nearly 50 dead men. The mother of the man whose casket she had stolen sued her for the scars it caused her emotionally after learning what she'd done with her dead son. You know, other than desecration of a corpse, I guess they could have charged the family of the corpse because she was assaulted, I guess you could say, with a dead weapon. The Karen Greenlee, for her part, said the body was just lying there. But it has what it takes to make me happy. The cold, the aura of death, the funeral surroundings, it all contributes. Well, during the Victorian era, an interest in spiritualism was growing, particularly in England. Seances and attempts to communicate with the dead were topics of both fervent discussion and participation by many. Perhaps this was encouraged by the common practice of post-mortem photography. It's also known as a mourning portrait. That's the practice of taking photos that are recently departed. Families began to take photos of their recently departed family members as a way of commemorating them. And in fact, my great-great-grandmother wore what she called a mourning pin after her husband died. And it was a photo of her husband. And many of that generation, when their significant others died, wore mourning pins. Now, these were quite grand affairs. The entire family would be dressed in their Sunday best, their formal suits and dresses, and they'd pose with the dead body as if that person was still alive. Dead person would also be dressed in their finest suit, or dress, depending on the gender. This was initially an activity only the upper classes could afford to do because the cost of hiring the photography and the cost of having the photos developed was quite expensive. But as the years passed and cheaper photography equipment was made, which opened up the opportunity for lower classes to pose for their mourning portraits as well. They became standard practice and quite common affairs due to their higher death rate in those days. Part of that was the lack of proper health care and contagious diseases. I mean, this can wipe out entire branches of a family tree. Many of these eerie photos still exist, viewable on the internet, of course, and most likely in many antique family albums. With the later development of the carte de visite, this enabled copies of the photos to be developed into multiple prints, and this meant the family could send photos of their dead family members to others in the family who lived far away, kind of like school portraits. Well, some of the photos show the dead with rosy cheeks, and as a result, looking very much alive and healthy. In actual fact, a colored tint was applied to their faces prior to the photographs being taken. Rumors were that metal sticks and stands were also used with which to hold up their arms or shoulders in order to make it look like they were standing, or at the very least, sitting upright. In fact, in many of these black and white photos, the dead look alarmingly alive, in some cases more alive than the live family members. Griffith Park in L.A. is one of the largest urban parks in America, and it's here that many mysteries and alleged cure reside. The park is said to have been cursed from the beginning back in the mid-19th century when it was ranch land and belonged to a wealthy bachelor, Don Antonio Feliz. Now, he died early when living with just his sister, his young niece, and their housekeeper. He contracted smallpox. In the 1860s, he lay on his deathbed. He was visited by a powerful local politician who drew up his last will and testament. Well, very surprisingly, or not surprisingly, depending on your view of the world, the will left everything to this politician, Antonio Coronel, and left his aunt and niece entirely out of the will. Well, after the bachelor died, the politician and the politician's lawyer claimed the will is legitimate and correct as per the wishes of the dead man. However, others heard the rumor the dying man had been assisted into agreeing to the conditions set out in the will by means of a stick pushed under his chin to move his head up and down in agreement, as though he assented and expressed his approval to the terms. Well, his niece, on hearing that she and her mother had been entirely written out of the will, which of course made them both homeless and penniless, was incensed. And according to legend, she uttered the words, "The wrath of heaven and the vengeance of hell shall fall upon this place. A blight shall fall upon the face of this terrestrial paradise. The cattle shall sicken. The fields no longer respond. The oaks die. The Feliz family shall be your curse." Well, maybe the politician came to his senses and took heed, because it wasn't long after that that he sold the ranch to his lawyer, of all people. As for the lawyer who'd accompanied him to visit the dying man and drafted this last will and testament, he was shot and killed in the midst of celebrating the sale of water rights to the ranch. The new owner, after the lawyer, tried to make the land a prosperous dairy farm, but his animals all became ill and died one by one. Fires broke out, devastating parts of the land. The next owner had his trees destroyed by a lightning storm, which not only caused the trees to fall to the ground, but a flood of water as well ran through the property, causing complete devastation. Farm workers later said they saw an apparition of the original owner, the bachelor, riding that huge wave of water in celebration of the destruction. Rumor was the owner believed his workers and was reluctant to spend time there alone after the report of this ghost figure on his huge horse. In fact, it wasn't long before he gave the land over to the authorities as just an outright gift. Well, the young couple was crushed to death not long after that when a tree fell on them as they lay beneath it. And the Washington Post went to do a special report on the history of the park in 2002. They spoke to one of the park rangers, Chief Ranger Albert Torres, who had been working there for many years. He was less concerned about an ancient curse and more vociferous about human actions in the park. He said, "I'm not afraid of the make-believe demons as much as I am of the living and breathing human monsters that come here. If you knew even a quarter of the stuff we find, you'd never set foot here again. Murders, sacrificed animals, satanic cults. We see it all on a regular basis." Well, the land here is comprised of canyons, sheer cliffs, crags, trails, and caves, and it's been the scene of a number of murder mysteries, including one very recently. In March of 2016, two hikers stumbled across a human skull that was lying partially covered on a small side trail, very close to the famous Hollywood sign. LAPD and forensic scenes of crime officers promptly arrived, but found little else to explain why the skull was lying there. Later, the county coroner determined it was a female skull belonging to a young woman, probably in her 20s, but had been lying there half hidden for anywhere from 1 year to 10. When reporters walked up the canyon the morning after the skull was found, the hikers they encountered looked spooked, but not entirely surprised by the discovery. Two hikers who made discovery told reporters, "Up here, it's off the beaten track. Anything could happen." And they were right. In 2010, a male skull was found by hikers. In 2012, a woman's head was discovered wrapped in a garbage bag by two other hikers. 24 hours later, the police found a shallow grave nearby that contained 2 feet and a hand. This time, fingerprints were taken from the fingers on the hand. The police were able to identify the victim. He was a man in his 60s. Rumors went around he'd been victim to a cannibal killer who'd recently killed and partially eaten somebody, or conversely, he might have belonged to a Mexican drug cartel. But in 2015, the suspect in the killing was identified as the man's boyfriend, who had, prior to scattering his lover's body parts, searched Google for how to butcher a human carcass for human consumption. Well, the hungry killer, of course, is now in prison, This next story comes from north of Sydney in Australia. When fisherman by the name of Peterson went out on his boat up the Hawkesbury River, he didn't know how that day would turn out. It was August 11th, 1994. He'd been there for some time when suddenly his fishing rod caught something big. He felt the heavy weight of it on his line and thought he was about to catch the biggest fish he had ever caught. When he reeled his line in with some effort, he found instead what was looked like a huge steel homemade crucifix tied to what appeared to look suspiciously like a dead body. The body was wrapped head to toe in black plastic. Wire was wrapped around its head and body. Rope was around its neck. It was clearly human cargo. Well, the fisherman went straight to the harbor where he summoned the police. Crime scene officers inspected the crucifix and the bones protruding from the plastic. Bodies taken to the morgue at the New South Wales Institute for Forensic Medicine. Eminent forensic pathologist Dr. Chris Lawrence went to conduct an autopsy. Now, one would have thought this was probably the strangest case he'd seen, but he's had other mysterious cases just as odd. Weird things tend to happen slightly more commonly than you'd expect. Strange and unusual things. I've had surprises in the past by very strange occurrences you couldn't anticipate happening. But occasionally they do occur. Well, this is how the experienced pathologist noted the body brought to him was a male between the ages of 20 and 40. Small stature. Bones are roughly anatomically arranged. Cause of death was likely to have been a heavy blow on the head. What he couldn't tell is whether the man had been dead prior to or after being strapped to that homemade giant crucifix. Crucifix was fashioned from steel into a giant frame which to hoist a dead man's body. It was nearly 2 meters long, and two round metal bars had been welded onto it, which reinforcing rods had also been attached. The man was then hung onto the crucifix, plastic wrapped around his body, and he was tied by wire and rope. Now, he might have been alive at that point in time, and in fact sacrificed on his makeshift crucifix. The pathologist determined he'd been dead between 5 and 2 years before the fisherman found him. And he was still wearing clothes when he had been attached to the crucifix. Well, the case became known as the Rack Man and became very well known in Australia. Chief Inspector John Lehman of the homicide team said at the time, "It's an unusual way to dispose of a person. They don't know if he was attached to the frame and tortured before he was thrown in, but clearly that did take place." Well, 20 years after the fact, that man is yet to be identified. Water had eroded his fingerprints. Interestingly, Professor Donald Anderson at Sydney University, an expert in entomology, studied barnacle attached to the steel frame and determined the crucifix had been in the water no more than a year. Now, the pathologist had determined the man died between 2 and 5 years ago. Or before he was found, rather. So where had the body been kept? Dead, attached to the crucifix for anywhere from 1 to 4 years. And why would they do that? Well, nobody knew. When able to identify the man who was clearly a homicide, his case was featured on Australia's Most Wanted, with a facial reconstruction of how he might have looked when he was alive. And the public flooded the police with tips and names, including drug dealers, career criminals, and somebody who was known as Rent-A-Killer. Some put forward a theory that the most likely candidate for the unidentified body tied to the crucifix was this hitman for hire who was known as Christopher Dale Flannery. He vanished in 1985. Well, Mr. Rent-A-Kill was formerly a bouncer in a nightclub and decided to hire himself out for contract murder jobs. He believed his first murder was that of a barrister named Roger Wilson. This took place in 1980, although the barrister's body was never found. And he was, the bouncer was acquitted of the alleged hit. Then he became a bodyguard to a Sydney crime boss named George Freeman, who was alleged to have attempted to kill a member of the police drug squad. 1985, he was due to meet with his crime boss, but his car wouldn't start. He called his crime boss to tell him he couldn't get his car started, told him to get a taxi and come to the meeting. Well, they got out of the taxi at the location of the meeting, started to walk down the street, and vanished. A former associate of his claimed the police themselves are behind his disappearance. 11 years later, the coroner for New South Wales determined he was very probably murdered, and the former detective with the police was the key to solving it. And that policeman said he had nothing to do with it, and of course, who's going to suspect a police officer? As for him being the man tied to the crucifixion dumped in the river, Rennekiller's dental records didn't match those of the remains. Was this death a gangrene-style killing, or carried out by some twisted pseudo-religious or occult belief? And why a crucifix? And why was his body kept so long before being dumped in the river? Well, the remains of Rackman are still lying in the morgue. If you have any idea, at least you can get yourself on Australia's Most Wanted. Also in Australia, there's a very eerie photo that was the last one a mother took before her family was destroyed. It was taken in 1979 when she and her husband John were on holiday in Sydney, Australia, with their two young sons. On their way to the Luna Amusement Park, when while walking through the quayside, their six-year-old son had his picture taken with a bizarre figure who was dressed in a leopard-skin loincloth and had a fur costume on the top half of his body that covered his face and head. Later, his mother would say that figure looked exactly like the demon Moloch. Well, they said he was just a busker, but the costume looked like the hide of a dead animal, and the headdress appeared to be that made out of animal hide. Black hollow eyes had been cut into the headdress, and the horns on his head made his appearance all the more sinister. But the young boy wanted his picture taken as the man in the headdress approached him, so the mother agreed. Standing side by side with this very strangely dressed man, this would be the last photo ever taken of her son. Family left the quayside and went on to the amusement park, where they enjoyed a number of rides together, until the boys wanted to go on the ghost ride, but their mother wanted ice cream. Later, she looked back on this with puzzlement, as she did the entire events of that day. As the boys went off with their father onto the ride, she went off to buy ice cream. When she came back, only a few minutes later, she found a nightmare scenario. Smoke was coming from the tunnel of the ghost ride, and as the train veered from the tunnel, staff and volunteers dragged the occupants out of their seats and rushed to put out the flames that were covering all of them. Well, amid the chaos of the scene, she struggled to find her husband and two sons, but they weren't there. The ghost train was still running, you see, and as it entered the tunnel and emerged once more, more people had dragged out of their seats. Those who hadn't been reached the first time, but still her family couldn't be found. Later, their bodies would be found huddled together inside the tunnel as they desperately tried to escape the flames. They were all dead. It was a long time after that before the mother could summon the strength to look at those holiday photos. It was in it she saw the last photo they had taken of her son with that odd-looking busker on the quay, and it was in it she came to believe something evil had been at play that day. When others saw that creepy photo, the comparison was made to Moloch, a demon who had a taste for burning children alive in sacrifice through the passing of the children through fire. Worship of Moloch was referenced in ancient Israel and in the Bible, and he was called a false god. Symbolically and literally, this was the way in which her sons had died. She also believed there was something very strange about the way in which she'd had a sudden, insatiable desire for ice cream, which led her to leaving her sons to go get one. She said later, "I'm not a religious person, but I have a feeling it was meant to be." She said, part of a larger story we don't have a say in. She said, "I never ate ice cream. I don't like it. But at this point in time, I had this craving for it, and it was totally bizarre. Got this thought that I had to have it. I feel it was all meant to be." Well, surely it was a very simple but very tragic accident. Or it could have been a fire set for insurance purposes. And most interestingly of all, no one's ever been able to trace the identity of the man in the strange animal costume. And no one else mentioned ever seeing the man, though she has a photo of him. Well, let's talk about the Croydon Cat Ripper. Now, it was in the London newspapers. The London Cat Killer Mystery deepened as police investigate over 100 deaths. Now, the death toll showed no signs of abating, according to the London newspapers, and it was spreading. South Norwood Animal Rescue Charity had been collecting and collating incidents over the year before. Originally, it was believed that whoever was doing the killings was only carrying them out in the South London area, specifically in the borough of Croydon. Then they realized it spread further. In the quaint market town of Guildford, an hour away from Croydon, a mutilated cat was found. An archway in North London, another. In Richmond, West London, still another. All these killings appeared to be linked. It had begun as the Croydon Cat Killer. That was happening London-wide in the counties that surrounded London. The macabre and grotesque evidence was being found everywhere. People said they were keeping their cats inside and those who had lost their animals said if they'd known, they'd have done the same thing. And in fact, it wasn't just cats that was being killed. Birds, foxes, rabbits, they've all been found mutilated as well. The charity said it knew of at least 100 mutilations. And mostly bodies with the heads and tails removed. We're used to seeing that same thing now. And they think it's the same person doing it each time. Chillingly, the organization's also convinced that the cats were killed, perhaps by being thrown against a wall, or in some instances, the perpetrator appeared to use bait to entice the animal to come to him. Separately, the Royal Society for the Protection of Animals had been investigating more than 20 cases, and in each of those cases, the tails and heads had been removed. In one day alone, three cats were found decapitated, all within about a 20-minute drive from each other. In a different spate of attacks, one witness told reporters, "I was walking to the underground in the morning. As I turned the corner, it was just there on the pavement. And the cut was clear. There was no blood. There was no head. No way another animal did this. It's distressing to me that if I left home earlier, I might have seen the killer with his knife. It's just a matter of time now before a human being is hurt by this lunatic." And her opinion was shared by forensic psychologist Dr. David Holmes, who told the London Evening Standard, "If he becomes bored in pursuing animals, he'll move on to targeting humans." Well, headless bodies of cats have been found as far away as the south coast of England. Whoever's doing it, they're traveling far and wide to strike, or perhaps it's a group working in unison. According to the news, quick succession of cat killings over the course of the weekend, 15 miles apart. It was suspected maybe the killer's a driver of a delivery truck, or maybe a taxi. In one particularly sadistic case, the cat had visible signs of torture and then was found dumped on its owner's front doorstep. Detective Sergeant Andy Collin, who'd been involved in some of the other investigations, said in terms of trying to profile the perpetrator, "These are being done by human hand. No particular days it's happening. It's far more random, though. Some had been found shot. Others have been eviscerated, their stomachs sliced open. Occasionally, they've survived and returned home, only for their owners to discover them seriously injured with knife wounds, severed limbs, or dislocated joints. And many others have been decapitated. Some of the local residents of Croydon have joined together, raising funds in order to try to have DNA from their cat's claws tested in order to find out the cats might have clawed their attacker and captured his DNA. Many cases, the killer has returned the cat to its home, left it for the owners to discover in the morning. They open the front door, they're confronted by the sickening sight of their beloved pet, dismembered, headless, and very often drained of their blood. So that means whoever the killers are knows who the owners of the pets are." For owner Penny Beeson, whose cat was killed, this is someone who gets pleasure out of this, out of upsetting people, someone who loves to have control. Very disturbed. Her cat had been found on her doorstep one morning, disemboweled. He'd been cut from his throat down. What's so chilling is this person had walked calmly up the garden path and laid him on the doorstep. Neatly arranged him. No blood in his body. Animal rights organization PETA said human or non-human, they have to be caught. They're a danger to everybody. Boudica Rising of the South Norwood Animal Rescue Charity believes that these are a form of ritual killing. The killer is letting the blood drain out for a specific reason and returning the pets to their homes. He's killing them someplace else, keeping them there until their blood is draining and bringing them back to their own homes. She said this has been going on for at least 5 years. Well, let's turn to Pennsylvania. You know, weird is everywhere. And you never know when you're going to come in contact with weird. In the 1890s, Mrs. Boger and her husband Charles were living in Pennsylvania when Mrs. Boger died suddenly of undetermined causes. She was pronounced dead by the family physician, and quickly her funeral was held. The husband was full of grief and missed his wife dreadfully when he suddenly heard the most disturbing piece of information. A friend of his now-dead wife told him that his wife used to suffer from a condition she termed hysteria. And the friend proposed the possibility maybe she wasn't dead at all, but had another episode of this hysteria. Of course, though her husband wanted nothing more than for his wife to be alive, he brushed it off as a ridiculous comment. But as time went on, especially when he was alone, he couldn't shake the idea from his mind. The possibility his wife could still be alive in her casket. Well, haunted by thoughts of this, eventually he couldn't rest till he confirmed for himself his wife was actually dead. Asking friends to go with him, he went to the cemetery and exhumed her body. As he laid the coffin on the ground beside the burial plot and opened up the casket, they were stunned to discover she was no longer lying face up in the coffin. She had somehow turned over. The white shroud she'd been buried in was now torn to pieces. Her body was covered in scratches. And worst of all, some of her fingers were now missing. Suggestion was later made, and in her anguish and desperation to get out of the coffin, she had gnawed on her own fingers. She tried to figure out how to get the coffin lid off. Eventually, of course, she failed to get the lid off and finally died, whether from suffocation or dehydration was unknown. Also in the 1800s in Pikeville, Kentucky, Octavia Hatcher had come down with a contagious disease that was running rampant through the residents of the town, killing many of them. After being ill for days, she finally passed into unconsciousness and died, even though she was very young. And the family doctor ruled her dead and signed her death certificate. Buried at the local cemetery quite quickly after her death, due to the hot summer weather making her body likely to decompose quickly. Her husband was grief-stricken, but he was also perplexed by the fact that many of the other residents in the area seemed to come down with the same condition his wife had, but in their cases, most of them regained consciousness after having slipped into comas. Seemed impossible, but most of them had gone on to make full recoveries. These circumstances began to haunt him and weigh on his mind. At night, he couldn't sleep. He began to wonder, was his wife really dead? What if she, too, had been in a deep coma, but had now regained consciousness like so many of his friends and neighbors had? He began to really fear the worst, and it wasn't long before he couldn't stop himself from demanding her body be exhumed. As the exhumation begun, he was there and in attendance, watching, and his worst possible nightmares were confirmed. The lining of the coffin had long, deep scratch marks. His wife's nails were bloodied and torn off, and her face was a death mask of absolute horror. She had been alive when she was buried. But she is dead now, after a struggle to break out of the coffin. Well, there have been quite a number of similar situations. Not so many in this day and time, but in earlier periods, most definitely. Now, Washington Irving was an American diplomat, and if you remember, he wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And he declared Arthur's Seat to be pure witchcraft. Now, Arthur's Seat is the main peak of a group of hills in Holyrood Park in Edinburgh, just a mile east of Edinburgh Castle. Arthur's Seat's been dated as far back as 350 million years when a volcanic eruption sent molten rock and ash across the area. Iron Age artifacts have been found in the area and it's believed it was a place for hunting back then, as well as many battles. The legend varied, but it goes something like this. In the 12th century, King David bequeathed the land to the church after an incident when he was almost gored by a stag. Well, as he fought with it, he said he saw the sign of the cross appear between the antlers of the stag. And this was how the name Holy Rod began, which means cross. Other sources say the antlers twisted into the shape of a cross as the king grappled with the stag. And from that moment, he determined to have an abbey built on that location. Others believe the name of Arthur's Seat came from King Arthur, with Edinburgh being a place where some of the Arthurian tales were said to have been centered. Well, in 1835, five boys were out searching for rabbits and looking for their burrows when they came across some very strange things. They found a series of tiny coffins, inside of which were miniature wooden figures dressed in clothes. The coffins were no longer than 4 inches in length, and the figures inside even smaller. Yet all were so intricately carved, they looked lifelike. They were discovered in a crag and were arranged in tiers with several coffins per row. On the lowest tier, the coffins suffered deterioration from the elements, but the top ones were remarkably preserved. And all the miniature figures were dressed in different outfits. Called the fairy coffins, a study was undertaken. It was determined they were made from Scots pine. Several of them can still be seen today in Scotland's National Museum. And it did appear that the coffins had not been buried at the same time, but had been placed over a long period of time, with the last deposit made shortly before they were found. To this day, though, more than 200 years later, nobody really knows why they were made or who made them or why they were put where they were found. The Scotsman newspaper suggests the most viable theory relates to the true tale of the body snatchers, Burke and Hare. He had murdered 17 victims to deliver the bodies for dissection at the medical school in Edinburgh. And it was 17 miniature dolls and coffins at Arthur's Seat. Had somebody spent hours of dedicated woodmanship crafting these tiny people in their miniature wooden coffins as some kind of memorial to the victims? George Dalgleish, a leading historian at the Scottish Museum, said at the time they'd begun to be buried there, which was about 1830, at the same time these body snatchers were carrying out their murders, people had a belief that a corpse being buried was necessary for resurrection. A dissected body would not be able to rise to life at the Last Judgment. So people were filled with horror at the thought of grave robbers. Another theory is that they were used in witchcraft ceremonies. And as Dalgleish said, we do know the area has always been associated with the supernatural. Although witches don't use voodoo dolls, Scotsman newspaper wrote at the time of their discovery, there are still some of the weird sisters about the area who retain the ancient power to work their spells of death by entombing the likenesses of those they wanted to destroy. Should this be the case, we congratulate the public on the discovery and destruction of the satanic spell manufactory, the last we should hope which the infernal hags ever be permitted to make. But was this really the work of witches, casting curses on their foes and burying their likenesses in tiny graves on the hillside? Curiously, in recent years, there have been a number of accidents, tragic deaths, and suicide at Arthur's Seat, which makes a lot of people wonder, is that area somehow cursed? Well, let's talk about necromancy. The summoning of spirits is an apparition of raising them bodily after death. That word also applies to communing with the dead. Now, accusations of witchcraft were rife in Scotland in the 1600s. What was most unusual, though, would be for a person to make an accusation about themselves that they were a witch. But such was the case of a Major Wire, who was a retired soldier and who was to be suddenly publicly proclaimed that he was indeed a wizard of the dark arts. What's particularly surprising was that he was a well-known figure in the local community of Edinburgh because of his staunch religious beliefs. Noticeable by his black clothing and accompanying black stick, which he took everywhere with him, he belonged to a very strict religious Presbyterian group, and as a member of this sect, he was believed to live a very disciplined and godly lifestyle. Certainly, he was highly regarded by his Presbyterian group, and indeed, he frequently held prayer meetings at his own home, which he shared with his spinster sister, Grizel. Now, he was known to be a somber, serious man of grave countenance. What nobody could have possibly prepared for was the day in which he stood up in public in front of the prayer group, and instead of passionately leading the prayers, he suddenly began to accuse himself of being a wizard who was in service to the devil. He said he was a necromancer. Now, that's the art of raising the dead and controlling their spirits, and the major said that's exactly what he did. He invoked the use of ancient black magic to raise the dead and make them do whatever nefarious acts he wanted, enslaving their souls and making them serve him for all eternity. When at first his shocked parishioners believed he had to be suffering from a fever that had caused him to become delirious, and much as they tried, they could not get him to shut up. His hideous proclamation was punishable by death, and besides which, there was not one of them who believed he could in any way be telling the truth. To them, it was as absurd as it was scandalous, and the very antithesis of everything he stood for. Unable to get him to shut up, though, they had no choice but summon a doctor who declared him to become mentally unbalanced. Well, this determination had prevented him from continuing to denounce himself. No matter where he went, he was his biggest accuser. He would inform everybody that he was an evil practitioner who was master of the darkest of arts. And he drug his sister into his accusations as well. Told everybody she was an evil woman who also performed the devil's work. The response of his sister to these accusations? Well, she agreed they were true. Said that together they practiced the most taboo sexual activities. His sister showed off a mark on her forehead, which was the shape of a horseshoe. Said the devil branded her with it. Said her mother had been a witch. She claimed that she and her brother would be whisked away by a mysterious stranger in black who took them aboard a wagon made of fire. Now, the major, meanwhile, was stauntly refusing to retract his confession of wizardry and seemed very happy to be sharing details of his actions. And I mean great details. Despite the authorities being reluctant to prosecute him due to his formerly upstanding character and reputation, in the end, they were forced to imprison him while they investigated his allegations. Allegations he leveled against himself. He stated his guilt to all and sundry and refused to seek any kind of pardon. They took away his black cane as well, as this too, he claimed, was a tool of ferocious power. He said the devil had given it to him. When he stood trial, the scandalous testimony shocked and horrified all who went to listen to it, and there were a lot, as you might guess. Understandably, he was found guilty, although to a lesser charge of unnatural sexual practices, including bestiality. Both he and his sister were found guilty, and both were sentenced to execution. He was to be hung and then burnt. Even when staring at death itself, he refused to recant, and he embraced his death willingly. His black cane was thrown into the fire with his body. As for his sister, when she was brought out next to be hung, she tried to do a striptease on the scaffold to the shock of the general public. Once dead, the reputations of the middle-aged brother and sister still refused to die down. Many local people who lived near their home began to describe strange things they had noticed about the couple in their home long before the major had publicly condemned himself. One such description included that of a huge female form which should be seen in the nighttime, her shadow being cast on one of the outside walls. And it was too large to have been an ordinary woman. Accompanying the sight, according to the neighbors, was a maniacal laughter. The cane of the major was reputed to have a life of its own, perhaps explaining why they had burned it along with the man. People spoke of it moving along the pavement ahead of him, totally independent of his hands. It seemed all along that despite him outwardly appearing to be an integral part of the religious community, to others he was long considered an evil occultist who communed with spirits to command him to do his bidding. Sir Walter Scott, in his Letters on Demonology and Witchcraft, wrote no story of necromancy, so many of which have occurred in Edinburgh, made much of an impression as the one of Major Wire. Believed for many years that the house in which the necromancy took place had been destroyed. But that wasn't true. And the strangest of twists, it appears to have been living in home to a Quaker community for the last 25 years. According to historian Dr. J. Bondison, quoted in the Scotsman newspaper, no person dared live in his house afterwards, but its windows were lit up at night with weird shapes flitting about and strange music was heard. It was decided by all and sundry that the house was haunted. Well, let's go to Lawton, Oklahoma. Halloween night, 1977. Nima Carter's parents placed her in her crib and went to bed. Early the next morning, the mother got up and went to get her 19-month-old daughter out of the crib and discovered to her shock the baby daughter wasn't there. The windows in the room were locked and hadn't been tampered with. Her abductor could only have come in a different way, and it was later suggested that the abductor had snuck into the house earlier in the day, hidden in the baby's closet, and waited there till everybody went to sleep. And certainly that was a possibility. Police were called, but they couldn't find no clues at all to help them work out where the baby had gone or who had taken her. A month went by, and a group of children were out playing in the neighborhood and went to an old abandoned house that their parents told them not to go to. As they explored the abandoned house, they went into the kitchen where one of them opened the refrigerator, and they all got the shock of their lives. Inside the refrigerator was the decomposing body of a baby. It was later determined this was the decomposing body of the baby girl that had been abducted from the Carters. Nobody was ever caught. No motive ever discovered. Didn't even have a suspect. In that same town in 1976, something very similar happened. A pair of 3-year-old twin girls, Mary and Tina Carpitcher, had been tricked out of their house by a young woman. She took them to another house where she had shut them into a refrigerator. Massive search for them was launched, and they were found in that house, still in the refrigerator. One of them had died, but the other one was still living. Child was able to identify the person who had taken her from her home, and it was the teenage girl that used to babysit him. Now, the problem with this prosecution was the child was so young, the court said her testimony wasn't wholly reliable. And in the end, no charges were ever brought against the teenage girl. Following year, that same teenage girl started babysitting for the parents of the little girl that was later found in a refrigerator at the old abandoned house. In 1986, another Halloween murder occurred. 15-year-old Orthodox Jewish boy named Chaim Weiss was a pupil at the Mizifta High School in New York. On the morning after Halloween, he was discovered dead in his dorm room. Apparently, he'd been beaten to death with a hard, sharp object and also stabbed multiple times in the head. There was blood everywhere, but the murder weapon couldn't be found. There was no sign of a struggle, and the police came to the conclusion he'd been attacked while he'd been sleeping in his bed and then his body drugged from the bed. The boy had been a popular student and certainly wasn't known to have any animals evil enough to have beaten him to death and then stabbed him. No sign of a forced entry, but a window was open. The killer, it was believed, had a good knowledge of Orthodox Jewish death customs. Because it was too cold to sleep with a window open, and traditional Jewish practice said that a window open would be useful for a dead body in order to allow the soul of the dead person to depart. Despite the long passage of time, nobody ever had been caught for that Halloween killing. On the outskirts of Georgetown, Texas, it's estimated she was probably in her 20s and she was naked, or rather she was naked except for her socks, had a bright orange. One of her hands, she was gripping a silver ring. It was established she'd been raped and then strangled. Believed she'd been strangled right after she had been raped. When the police failed to establish the woman's identity, from then onwards, the newspaper called her Orange Socks, original name. was to be several years later that the notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas stepped forward and confessed to being the one who had raped and killed that unidentified young woman. He said he'd picked her up while she'd been hitchhiking. Said he had she had told him her name was Judy. He said that after he picked her up in the truck, he strangled her and then raped her dead body. Then he dumped her by the roadside in a culvert and drove away. He was tried for the murder, and since he confessed, found guilty of it. Of course, he later recanted his confession. In fact, additional investigation into her murder and whereabouts of the serial killer on the day she was abducted and murdered showed he was most likely in a different state at that time. So it became very possible it was another victim he lied about, as he had a habit of doing. He'd frequently claim he'd killed various victims, and although he was believed to have killed many, many people, he also confessed to many others that he actually couldn't have killed. Morning after Halloween in Walker County, Texas, a trucker was driving along Interstate 45 when he caught sight of something very disturbing. He could see the dead body of a young female lying by the roadside. When the police arrived, they determined the young woman had been sexually assaulted and beaten to death. When the story was reported in the local press, witnesses began to come forward saying they had seen her on Halloween night. Seen she'd climbed out of a car at the gas station nearby and approached a number of drivers asking them for directions to the local prison, the Ellis Unit. Told them she'd going to visit a friend of hers at the prison. Oddest thing was, when her photograph was shown to all the prisoners there, none of them claimed to have known her. The murdered woman had also talked to a waitress at the restaurant. Waitress said that when they'd been chatting, the girl said she'd run away from home because her parents didn't care anything about her. Well, they never established her real identity. And as her killing was similar to the girl with the yarn socks, the police wondered if she'd become a victim of Henry Lee Lucas. Although the other killings he confessed to, he actually hadn't done. Also, the bite marks found on the victim's body didn't match his teeth. Later years, some experts have theorized she was actually murdered by a woman rather than a man because a foreign object had been inserted into her, but no sexual assault in a traditional sense had taken place. Well, she's never been conclusively identified, and no one has been arrested for her murder. New York City, October 31st, 1991. Elizabeth Plotzman and Ron Sisman were murdered in their own home. They'd been severely beaten and then shot, execution style. The apartment had been ransacked. Rumors were the man had been involved in the drug trade, and so it was thought to have been a motive for their death. But things were to take a strange turn when an informant claimed that a fellow inmate, he was incarcerated at the time he made this confession, had foretold these deaths several weeks before they'd occurred. The inmate turned out to be none other than David Berkowitz, the infamous Son of Sam. He'd been convicted of a number of random shootings that had cost the lives of six people. Ever since his capture, though, there's continued to be suspicion and rumor he's involved in a shadowy satanic cult, and he hadn't acted alone in carrying out the killings. According to the prison informant, after the couple were found dead on Halloween in their apartment, he said it was Berkowitz who confided in him weeks earlier that there'd be murders that night, and he'd supposedly described exactly how they'd go down. Details he allegedly given were remarkably similar to the events of that night when the couple had died. Told his prison friend it was going to be a ritual murder, also being done to remove some incriminating evidence the man had about the Son of Sam killings, which had taken place 20 years before. Well, Berkowitz went on to claim the man who'd been targeted in his own home had to be killed and something removed from his apartment. That something was a video recording of the murder of one of the Son of Sam victims, a snuff film. Although the authorities are quick to dismiss these claims, the description that the man in prison gave of the layout and personal items in the apartment where the murder took place was extremely accurate. Well, we've come to the end of another show. I'll be back live tomorrow night. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.